This morning, the court has on its oral submission docket three causes. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. T.O. Stanley Boot Company, Incorporated and others versus the Bank of El Paso from El Paso County. Religious of the Sacred Heart of Texas and others versus City of Houston from Harris County. And Star Telegram Incorporated and others versus the Honorable Jeff Walker, an original mandamus proceeding. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner or relator may save out a certain portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded on tape for the convenience of the court. Some portions of them may also be video recorded by a private concern. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each oral argument, but we will complete the submission of all of these causes before our lunch break. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in T.O. Stanley Boot Company versus Bank of El Paso.
May it please the court, Mr. Roberts and Mr. Hoagland will present arguments for the petitioners. Mr. Roberts will open. He is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, this is a case involving the T.O. Stanley Boot Company, which was at one time called the T-Bar-S Boot Company and had approximately 200 employees in El Paso. The manufacturing plant had approximately 25,000 square feet, or about 8 or 10 times as large as this room. And they manufactured a very high quality of boots. In that time when T-Bar-S was in existence, they had a line of credit with this same bank, with the Bank of El Paso, and that the bank's records indicated that. And I say that because it indicates a course of dealing and course of conduct over the years. They had no written agreement for that line of credit either, as there is no written agreement in this particular instance. However, because of the fact that the largest customer of that particular company, T-Bar-S, went bankrupt, and the major of the two banks lending the company also went bankrupt, the T-Bar-S found itself in an insolvency situation. And when it occurred, Clark Harvey, the president of this bank, said to them, and they discussed the fact that they should go through bankruptcy, and that once they were out of bankruptcy, they could come back to this bank and they would resume their banking operations and restart the business on a going basis. They did go through bankruptcy. T.O. Stanley had a personal note in the amount of, I believe, around $48,000 or $65,000, I forget which one it was. The bank got the trustee in bankruptcy to abandon all of this boot-making equipment that filled this 25,000-square-foot building to the bank, and the bank either had it on their books at $25,000 or they told the trustee it was an insignificant value in order to get it abandoned. But then, as planned, whenever this bankruptcy got over with, well, T.O. Stanley and his group came back to the bank and said, okay, now we're ready to resume our business. We would like to continue our banking relationship. We need a line of credit. We want to put some money into this new business, and we want you to commit to give us a certain amount of money over a period of time, $500,000. The evidence is that that agreement was made, that over a period of time, the investors were to put $300,000 in, or $250,000, I forget which. And the evidence is clear that one of the investors put $333,000 of his hard-earned cash into this after having signed a guarantee, an unlimited guarantee, as the others did, based upon the representations that there was a line of credit available for $500,000. So these men actually put not only their time and their lives, but they put over $350,000 in cash money into this operation. And what did the bank get at the time they made this agreement? They had a debt which had been discharged in bankruptcy from the T-Bar-S. They required these people to buy the equipment from the bank at the price equal to the amount of that debt. So what they got was a discharged debt rendered back paid. They got the first monies that were given to the corporation went back to the bank to buy this equipment, and some of it went for interest, which they also required the buyers to guarantee the personal loan of T.O. Stanley. So the bank actually got virtually all of the first $70,000 or $80,000 increment of money that occurred, and there was not any substantial amount of it to go to the corporation. Later on, a few months later, another investor, Mr. Ruby, came on the scene and wanted to become an investor in the corporation. At that particular time, also, there were other representations made to him by the bank that this line of credit existed. He indicated he would not have signed an unlimited guarantee himself had it not been for the fact that they had this agreement. So, to make a long story short, there is very ample evidence that the bank told these people on repeated occasions, not just once, that they would make this kind of arrangement. We believe that they had no intention of ever doing it for several reasons. Number one, they testified they didn't make the contract, that there was no contract, and certainly you can't say, as they are trying to, we didn't have a contract, but we performed it. You either have to say we didn't have one and we didn't intend to perform one, or we did have one, but you can't have it both ways. Now, there's other evidence that they did not intend to perform it. There's evidence of the fact that the very day that the first loan was made, Clark Harvey, the president of the bank, in records that can't be disputed, thank goodness, told a young man named Danny Nasser, prepare an SBA package or loan application that day. He testified under oath that that never came up until the next year. We know from their records it did come up. They did intend from the very beginning to dump this thing off onto an SBA loan. What that allowed them to do is to make whole their entire losses from the prior TBRS, get these people committed, give them some amount of money, get them committed, and then say, okay, no more money unless you do this on a guaranteed loan, and then these people would have been put in an SBA loan, and as the court can see from our brief, the terms of it were impossible for a business like this to comply with. They had to, for every $5,000 they were going to spend, they had to go back to the SBA and get approval. And I'm going to tell the court that the evidence is that 10 pair of boots, of alligator boots, would cost more for the leather than that. They couldn't have run a business like that.
Counsel, you state that the petitioners rejected the SBA loan because of the terms and conditions of the loan. Is that correct?
Well, they rejected it. They already felt they had a commitment from this bank, but when the bank says, we're not going to let you have any more money and your only alternative is this, what are you going to do?
Were the terms and conditions unacceptable?
Oh, yes, sir.
But yet, looking at the record, there is no testimony as to what the interest rate was, what the repayment schedule was. All the vital terms, or a good many of the vital terms, are totally missing.
Well, there is testimony, Your Honor. If the court please, there was testimony that they were to have the same deal they had had with the TBRS, and that's the reason I said course of dealing, and it was to be at 1.5% over prime, and that is in fact what the note was, that the notes that were signed was consistent with that. And I agree that there was no specific statement of we're going to pay back X dollars at a certain time. But the point is they hadn't gotten the money. You don't start to pay it back until you get it. And that's what a line of credit is. I start to pay it back as I get it based on I take a little bit now, and I take a little bit more a little bit later, and I start paying it back eventually. But that's, I understand what the court's saying, and there are no specific terms stated. But this is a course of dealing that had gone on for years and in an acceptable fashion. With the same kind of unwritten agreement and the same kind of terms.
Let me ask you, you say they expected it and thought it was going to be on the same terms and conditions as the prior line of credit.
Yes, sir.
Now, was the prior line of credit, was it approved by the loan committee of the bank?
the records don't reflect one way or the other, other than the fact that they did in fact act, the bank did in fact loan money on a line of credit for many years to TBRS. Presumably the bank knew what it was doing when it loaned the money.
On the prior line of credit, was there written documentation?
No, sir. Other than in the records that there was no written agreement, there was documentation in the records that we introduced into evidence that showed the bank called what the TBRS had a line of credit. Yes.
Was there a note?
There were numerous notes, but just like this one, there was no what I want to call master note. There was no master note. There were separate notes in the TBRS just like there were here. The bank then had gotten a tremendous benefit and gotten investors who were solvent and liquid to give unlimited guarantees for these particular obligations. At that point in time, then the bank said no more, and there were no more advances made. We think it's further evidence that there was such a contract by virtue of the fact that there were two letters sent to the bank, which are in evidence, saying you are violating your agreement with us. We had an agreement that you were going to give us $500,000. And at no time did the bank ever write them back and say, no, we didn't. We didn't have any such agreement. They never responded to nor denied to these people that that agreement existed at that time. And that was just immediately before they made their last advancements. Now, then the business went broke because of the fact that there wasn't any money coming in. And that's basically the factual background. The issues that we believe are crucial and legal issues here. Number one, the failure to preserve virtually all of these complaints that were made and heard by the Court of Appeals. On the fraud issue, the court rendered judgment even though at no point in either the motion for instructed verdict or the motion for new trial was there any point on fraud, and there was no possible way for rendition of the case, and yet the Court of Appeals rendered judgment, and it was totally improper there. And I can't go into each one of the failures to preserve the error because they're so numerous and they're different and they're treated in the brief, but basically that is an example of the failure to preserve error that existed. Now, one of the main points that the Court of Appeals made was that since there was no contract, there could be no fraud. And we have cited a case called Allison versus Harrison to this court, and the logic of it makes no sense, that you can't cheat somebody unless you make a contract with them first. In other words, there's no actionable fraud unless you sign a piece of paper that becomes a contract. If you induce them into some transaction that is not a legal contract and cause them to give you all their money, then apparently that's all right with the Court of Appeals. But that is not what Allison versus Harrison said. And it's not the law, and it's not equity. And fraud is a doctrine that you have equitable rights on. So basically, the Court of Appeals was wrong, and that is the basis for their holding, and we believe that is a basis that this court can render on in this case without going back to the Court of Appeals for anything else. And also, there were contracts. I presume they believe that these guarantee contracts they sued on were enforceable contracts that were made at the same time that the loans were made. Certainly, they sued on them, and certainly the notes were, they believe, enforceable. So there were contracts made at the time. Now, the second major point to me is that the Court of Appeals used exactly the opposite test from what it should have in determining the sufficiency of the evidence, legal and factual. It took all the evidence against the judgment and cited it and ignored all the evidence in favor of the judgment and the verdict. Now, we all know that is not anywhere close to a proper test. Breach of contract, this is the area, this is one of the points that you all granted us on, and we believe that the bank is really caught in this inconsistent position as to that. They can't say there wasn't any contract, but yet we gave substantial performance by making the SBA application.
Counsel, I'm looking at some documents that were provided to the court as exhibits, and you refer to guarantee agreements, but yet the guarantee agreements bear a date that's substantially different from the date you say the contract was entered into?
There were several guarantee agreements, Your Honor. There were some, and there were some later ones.
Were there any guarantee agreements signed within, say, 1 month of the date you say the contract arose?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How many of them and for what amount?
Well, there were unlimited guarantee amounts. They weren't limited in amount, and they were signed at the time the original notes were made. And then Mr. Ruby signed his later on because he only came on the scene some months after that.
But isn't it your contention that the original contract took place in December?
Yes, sir.
Okay, were there any guarantees signed in December?
My recollection is there were, Your Honor, yes.
Mr. Roberts, let me take you back to one of your last points. You said that the Court of Appeals said where there's no contract, there can be no fraud. Actually, the Court of Appeals said that the tort claim would have to be grounded on detrimental reliance, and there was no proof that there was any promise other than to obtain a loan. The Court of Appeals said that that loan was obtained through the SBA, and thus that promise discharged. Do you disagree with that?
I agree with your statement. I can't agree with that. That's the evidence at all. I mean, we have reams of testimony quoted to the court that show that these people relied on a promise not to make an application with the SBA, but for this bank to loan $500,000 itself, not to get some loan guaranteed sometime in the future that they didn't even know about at the time that the promise was made.
Can you obtain a jury finding on the base on those terms?
We certainly did.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear.
Would you ease all the time?
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, my name is William Allensworth, Haynes and Boone, and I represent the Bank of El Paso. The Court of Appeals' opinion in this case can be affirmed on a number of different grounds. I'll summarize them real briefly, that this was a contract rather than a fraud case. Statute of frauds barred the contract. The terms were too indefinite to be enforced anyway. There wasn't any evidence of the breach. There's no evidence to support a submission of contract damages. To the extent if indeed this could be submitted duly as contract and fraud, the fraud would be barred by Town North Bank versus Broadus, because the representation would be directly in conflict with the note that you have there in front of you. There's no evidence of the falsity of the alleged representation, no evidence of intent. Their impairment of collateral argument, which is a defensive issue, which was waived, and their guarantees and the notes they signed, and the evidence established as a matter of law, our entitlement to affirmative relief in this case.
Mr. Ellsworth, with regards to some of these theories that you say the Court of Appeals can affirm, some of these were factual matters that you lost before the trial court, and you made the same argument. There was no evidence of a breach, and you lost on that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We lost those at the trial court. The Court of Appeals correctly held that there was no evidence, or there is no evidence in the record to support that finding, and to each of which findings we objected via objection on no evidence grounds and a motion for JNOV.
Now, what about the argument that the Court of Appeals stood the standard of review on its head? It just looked at the case the way just opposite it's supposed to. Rather than looking at the evidence to support the judgment, they were looking for evidence to bust the judgment.
Well, there was a lot of the Court of Appeals discussed a substantial amount of their evidence, and indeed it discussed some of the evidence that we presented, and which would be inappropriate on a no evidence ground. The point that I'm making to the court is that that judgment nevertheless can be affirmed just looking at the evidence favorable to the borrowers in this case and ignoring any of the evidence submitted in behalf of the bank, that it nevertheless can and should be affirmed. Starting with the different arguments that on which that case can be affirmed, The Court of Appeals, without expressly saying so, I think recognized that this was an attempt at a dual submission of both fraud and contract claims, and that under those circumstances, in light of this court's opinion in Southwestern Bell versus Delaney, and the discussion of Professors Prosser and Keaton cited in that opinion, that this case should not be, that this was an action that was essentially in contract, and that it ought to be assessed on the basis of a contract, absent a special relationship of which there was no evidence here. And that rationale, as suggested by Professors Keaton and Prosser, is that the availability of tort and contract theories for the same kind of loss ought to be limited in order to simplify the law and to reduce the cost of litigation. And of course, there's other reasons, which this court's discussed before. It gives effect, most notably, it gives effect to the party's agreement. This is a case in which it's alleged that we breached an oral agreement to commit to a $500,000 loan. The evidence can be gauged in terms of whether that agreement existed and whether we breached it. Indeed, in terms of other reasons why this ought to be gauged by contract rather than tort reasons, the nature of the injury here is an economic loss, as this court pointed out in Jim Walter Holmes. There is no evidence of a special relationship, as the concurring opinion in Delaney discussed. This is a banker-borrower relationship. It is not a professional relationship. It's not attorney-client. There's no fiduciary relationship. There's no other overlay of relationships that would turn this into a tort case rather than a contract case.
What about the course of business argument that
Mr. Your Honor, the course of dealing that he's referring to there is this bank's relationship with a prior bankrupt separate entity in which the bank had improvidently advanced funds to that entity, TBRS.
Prior to the bankruptcy, the banker and bank president sat down with the principals involved in the corporation and go ahead and file bankruptcy once that's taken care of the whole thing.
No, sir. The evidence in this record deals with a meeting that occurred on December 5, 1986, after they had filed bankruptcy.
Is there evidence in the record that they had this agreement that subsequent to the bankruptcy, they would continue this line of credit course of dealing?
No, sir.
They had practiced before.
No, sir. No, sir. He can talk about the bank's relationship with TBRS. No, sir. In terms of the contract, the alleged contract here, which is the basis, Your Honor, of a meeting that occurred on December 5, 1986, at which time their evidence, read in the light most favorable to them, is that the bank president agreed that the bank would extend a $500,000 line of credit to them, which was subsequently guaranteed. Taking their evidence, they say that deal was struck, and their claim is that the bank failed to honor that agreement. The bank loaned them about $235,000, loaned the company $235,000, but that the bank had reneged on its agreement to loan them $500,000. The first point that they have to deal with is that this is essentially a breach of contract action, and that alleged contract is squarely within the statute of frauds. And the reason for that is demonstrated in this case particularly. The reason for having the statute bar the enforcement of this sort of oral contract, the uncertainty of the terms that they're talking about, and the court, I think, may have recognized the difficulties that the plaintiffs have in setting forth the terms of that loan agreement, and I'm going to deal with that here in a second. The difficulty of reliance on memory or the casual nature of these sort of alleged obligations. But taking all of the evidence in this case, all 116 pages of their briefing, particularly the 14 or 16 pages of their appendix, which sets forth what they feel to be their evidence as to what the terms are of this loan, ignoring any evidence that we had, they haven't been able to prove up, as the Court of Appeals correctly held, the terms of any contract between us and them with enough specificity for this court or any other court to enforce it. They mentioned, and indeed, my colleague just now mentioned, well, to look at the course of dealing with TBRS, which I'm going to suggest to the court is irrelevant, whatever dealings that was with a different entity. He admitted that the interest rate on the loan was never settled upon. The closest they could get to that at trial was that they thought they'd be able to borrow this $500,000 somewhere between 1.5 and 2.5 over prime. The note in front of you happens to be at 1.25 over prime, and that's the last note that they executed. There's no talk about the payback or what terms the line of credit would be serviced or paid back. They say that when we got them, when they applied for an SBA loan, which would involve funds advanced by us but guaranteed by the SBA, that they didn't like that interest rate. They didn't like the fact that they were going to have to service the debt other than paying interest for the first year. They didn't like the fact that they were going to have to collateralize that debt. But they can't point to any terms of the alleged agreement that three of them struck with us on December 5, 1986 under which we'd loan them $500,000. The case that I'd suggest to the court to is Pine versus Gibraltar, which is an NRE case cited in our brief, which in many ways is very similar to this in that it involves an alleged oral promise agreement to provide takeout financing for a home builder, but in which none of the terms that would be necessary for any sort of a banking relationship to exist were discussed, like loan to value, what the interest rate was, the payout, the maturity. What this creates is demonstrated in this case. Without them being able to point to the terms, it makes it difficult for us to prove compliance with the alleged oral contract, or conversely, it makes it difficult, if not impossible, for them to prove how we breached it. The evidence here was that they submitted an application for an SBA loan for $500,000. They passed a corporate resolution to do it. They applied for the loan, and they got it. The SBA imposed a lot of conditions on it, but it was going to be a loan guaranteed by the SBA and funded by us. They didn't like the interest rate, and I discussed a little bit of that just a moment ago, but I'd suggest to the court that there's no evidence of the breach of the contract, them having gotten a thing. And also, there's no evidence of damages in this thing, which we objected to in a timely fashion. There's no attempt to submit benefit of the bargain here except for a lost profits issue, which they didn't submit as a lost profits issue. They submitted as a loss of earnings issue over objection and with a timely filed proper objection in written form. The evidence, the damages they submitted were loss of credit standing, lost business reputation, mental anguish. Now, they didn't have the benefit of this court's opinion in Sloan, but loss of employment, losses on the sales of their stock, where they say they invested in the company and then had to sell it to each other, all of which are reliance damages, which are unavailable to them when the cause of action is for contract. Your Honors, in the event that this case, the court was going to allow a dual submission of contract and fraud, the Court of Appeals judgment nevertheless can be affirmed on the grounds that the note in the second line of it, the line right after where they say, I promise to pay when due the sum of $237,000, The next line says that there will be no additional advances are contemplated on that note. Their theory of fraud is that additional advances were contemplated on that note to the tune of $500,000. That is directly in the face of the note. That parole evidence is inadmissible under Town North versus Broadus, and that contention ought to get barred, and that ought to be barred, because to hold otherwise would essentially render meaningless this commercial paper. And there is no evidence of artifice, trickery, or deceit in this case in the context of Town North. This isn't a case where somebody signed a birthday card and really underneath it there was a carbon that said that was on that note. They're talking about discussions that led to this, the effect of which, if granted, if the parole evidence rule was disregarded in this case, would render meaningless that commercial paper. There's no evidence that we didn't intend to perform. The only evidence is that we didn't perform. That's not enough. For these reasons, both their fraud and estoppel claims are going to go, I suggest, there is no evidence to support either one of them. I'm going to, one other point that was noted by the Court of Appeals, and one of the justices mentioned it earlier this morning, and that was that the discussion took place on December 5. The first of these guarantees was signed, I think, on December 15. One of the other guarantors, who never even saw or heard of us until March, guarantor Ruby, came in March of 1987 and signed some additional guarantees. They wrote us the two letters that he's describing in October of 1987, complaining about the bank's failure to honor its oral commitment for the loan. But 3 weeks after that, they signed the note that you have there in front of you. The guarantees that they signed, the most recent of which was signed considerably after that initial discussion in December of 1986.
What about his argument that you never denied that there was a contract? They wrote you some letters and said you failed to comply with the contract, and you never said, well, we don't have a contract, we don't have any agreement. And that, in some manner, proved that your theory is incorrect.
Well, what their argument there was that their argument was that we told them to submit an SBA loan application. They went through the exercise of submitting the loan application when they said, if their evidence is to be believed, taking everything they say is true, that they had no intention of getting one, or that they didn't like the terms, and that after they had refused the SBA application, after they'd said, this is the bank letting us off the hook, or that we're not going to let the bank off the hook, they executed the last set of guarantees in this case. Your Honor, if I could wrap up with a couple of other things. On the impairment of collateral, that is a defensive issue. It's available only to the maker of the note. The maker has expressly waived it in the note that you've got in front of you. The guarantors waived it as well, though not in terms quite as explicit in their guarantee. But because of this decision, the court's decision, FDIC versus Coleman, they don't have any basis to hang their hats on that anyway. In any event, there's no evidence that we impaired their collateral. We indeed are entitled to recover. There's no obligation under Texas law or any other that we, on our affirmative claims, that we proceed initially by a motion for summary judgment or even by a motion for constructed verdict or otherwise. We filed a motion for judgment and asked for judgment on the grounds of those notes, which judgment was not granted by the district court, but should have been granted, but the Court of Appeals correctly recognized that there was no fact question on those notes. none is raised or even suggested in their brief. They have a mention of whether we should be getting paid $7,500 for the rent that we had to pay to protect their collateral before they got a TRO to get the collateral back. But we're not asking for but that rent is not mentioned in the judgment. The judgment is exclusively for the amount of the note and the interest that's due on it, which is susceptible and was proven at trial with a mechanical calculation as to how much is due, and the judgment of the Court of Appeals correctly recognizes that and gives us judgment for it.
Briefly, Mr. Allensworth.
Yes, sir.
What is the status of discovery in the trial court? What is the status of discovery in the trial court?
I don't think that there's any in terms of what...
Motion for leave to file mandamus has been filed in this court. Also, in this connection, regarding some discovery in the trial court, you're not aware of it, pending problems there.
I'm not aware of it. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm sure that's not an issue
Thank you.
Now.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor. It pleases the court, counsel.
Same question to you. Do you know what the status of discovery is?
I know it's pending. There's post-judgment discovery that has been submitted to the bank, which they didn't want to respond to. I did not join in the mandamus. I don't mandamus unless I have very dire cause to do so.
So you don't have any update on the issues that are raised there?
Thank you. None, Your Honor. The evidence clearly shows that our clients would not have entered into the enterprise of T.O. Stanley Boot Company without adequate capitalization. That's the issue in terms of whether or not there's a tort cause of action. The nature of the loss in Southwestern Bell Telephone versus Delaney, the court discussed the fact that the nature of the loss determines whether or not there's a contract or a tort action. In this instance, my client invested $333,000 in a business based upon his belief that there was a line of credit to $500,000 available at that bank. He indicated that he put in his first $50,000 of investment without that knowledge, but that he put all of his subsequent funds in there with that knowledge. All of the gentlemen testified without adequate capitalization, they never would have started up the business enterprise of T.O. Stanley Boot Company. They wouldn't have invested their money. They wouldn't have invested their time. Clark Harvey testified that he never made any representations whatsoever about a $500,000 loan. This evidence was clearly contradicted by the bank's own witness, Tim Tyler, who said on at least two occasions himself that there was no representation of a $500,000 loan until he was confronted with his own deposition testimony and recanted and gave every element of fraud in answer to cross-examination questions. He admitted that they wouldn't have gone into the business enterprise without that representation. He admitted that they all relied on it. He admitted that it was a misrepresentation of the bank, and that as a result of their reliance on that misrepresentation, all of these gentlemen and the company suffered damage.
Counsel, can you tell me the evidence, what evidence there is of the difference in terms between the SBA loan that was offered and which you rejected and the terms of the loan that you say you and the bank agreed to?
The significant differences are that the SBA loan called for immediate principal reductions. The pro formas controlled the payback on the loan. Lawrence Harmel testified that there was that in his
On the loan to the, you're talking about the line of credit with the bank?
Right. The lines of credit are renewed on an annual basis. This is what Lawrence Harmel testified to. We're not in a vacuum. We know how banks operate here. Also, SBA loan required immediate principal reductions. Merrill said this was bad. The pro forma called for losses all of the first year. Ruby testified regarding the pro forma as well. The interest rate was a floating rate higher than that given by the bank, and everyone talked about that. The SBA loan proposal showed that it was bailing out the bank's loans to the debtor and that there was not a full extension of the $500,000 line in that instance. There was additional accounting requirements under the SBA loan on inventory and accounts. Also, there was significant collateral increases on the loan required by the SBA.
Excuse me for a second. You're relying strictly on course of prior dealings to supply these terms, or do you say this is part of the oral agreement?
No. Yes, you asked me the difference between the SBA loan and the loan as it was understood by my clients. our clients, in terms of what the terms were, there were very clear terms about the collateral. It was the accounts receivable, the inventory, the equipment, plus the personal guarantees. The SBA, in addition, wanted $300,000 of Circle K stock that my client didn't
even have.
My
question is, was that part of the oral agreement, or is that, are you relying on a course of dealings to supply those missing
terms? That's reflected in the documents, and it's reflected in their course of dealing.
The December date, were those terms discussed?
Those terms were discussed.
On the December 5th meeting date?
Which terms are we talking about?
Terms,
all of the terms?
The terms of the loan with the bank.
That is correct. They were discussed in meetings leading up to the December 5th meeting as well. And there were additional representations subsequent thereto to my client, Jim Ruby, who didn't really come onto the picture until March of 1987.
What evidence is there in the records related to the prior course of dealing with
The evidence about the prior course of dealing is reflected in the testimony of T.O. Stanley, who talked about the fact that he basically expected it to operate as it had previously. Also, there were exhibits introduced regarding the fact that there was a line of credit without a written loan agreement for TBRS. TBRS was made up of different people than T.O. Stanley, but it had the same principle.
Any other questions? That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.